go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
Ben, I want to talk about a topic today that is it's kind of crazy, really. It's a little bit of science, a lot of speed, just a really, really cool topic, I think, and that's hypersonic flight.
Yeah.
Which is beyond sonic flight. So we're talking about beyond like the speed of sound. We're talking about like Mach
20.
Mach 20. Yeah, believe it or not, we're going to talk about vehicles that can get up to Mach 20. So far unmanned, which is not really probably news to anybody. I mean, other than, you know, the spaceships that are reentering our atmosphere. But they're talking about, you know, jetting people around the world or jet rocketing people around the world in a matter of hours, right?
Yes.
All the way around the world, which is incredible.
Yes. Can you imagine Magellan's surprise?
Yeah, I mean, imagine being on the exact opposite side of the Earth in like 4 hours.
Yes, and imagine going from New York to Los Angeles in only 12 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, we had a vehicle that I'm sure a lot of people are saying, well, we've already had a sonic vehicle, right? A supersonic vehicle, rather. The Concorde, right? And, you know, I started looking up a little bit of information about the Concorde, and it had quite a history. It had kind of a negative ending there with the crash.
Right.
But I started looking at videos, and I got in this video wormhole, you know, where you start looking at one and then another, and it leads to more things. And suddenly, I don't know, I'm looking at crazy stuff. But 27-year history on the Concorde. The top speed was like 1,350 miles per hour, something like that. Now, Mach 1, which is the speed of sound, is right around 768 miles an hour, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So you're traveling at a speed of like 1 mile every 5 seconds. That's the speed of sound. But, the Concorde, which was almost double that. I mean, I can't do the math off the top of my head, but, anyways, 1,350 miles per hour, regularly traveled about 1,200 miles an hour. That was typical, but it made an exceptionally fast trip from, what was it, New York to Paris? Is that right?
Yes. It made a record-setting transatlantic flight.
Yeah, and it would do this regularly, right? It was
a
back-and-forth, all first class, 100 passengers, champagne the whole way, that type of thing. It was a big deal to fly in the Concorde, right?
Yes.
There's a lot of information out there about how special it was to fly in this and the little gifts that they would give you and, you know, the nice features and just to be able to say that you flew on the Concorde is pretty cool.
The swag alone.
It cost quite a bit of money, I know. It was like, you know, the neighbor, I'm going to ballpark it here, Bank, from what I read. But wasn't it something like $6,000 or $8,000 to fly in this thing?
Yeah, it was quite expensive. Yeah. Certainly not a JetBlue ticket.
Yeah, now we mentioned that they did have an incident. It was coming, a flight from Paris. They were headed, where were they headed to? I can't remember where they headed to. Maybe back to New York, I'm not sure. Oh, you know what? I'm sorry. It was a tour group that had chartered this flight.
That's right.
It was flight 4590. And you can find out all this information about it. That's kind of the dark spot on this. But that's the only incident, really, that had fatalities. It was a big one. I mean, everybody on board and, you know, some people on the ground and everything. There's even some footage of, you know, because it was a big deal when it took off.
Yes.
Anytime. Because it was really cool to see. It was a neat plane or neat jet, I guess. So there's a lot of video footage of this thing taking off and landing every time it flew. So they happen to have film footage of this thing, you know, on its fateful flight, taken off, and also the crash. But that's kind of our first foray, I guess, into supersonic flight with passengers on board. I mean, other than like military personnel, right?
Right. And now we are entering a brave new world. I say that unironically of seriously, man, science fiction vehicles. It is amazing, the vehicles that we're about to talk about. Of course, they are in the developmental stages, right?
Yep.
And, you know, I get kind of carried away with this stuff, Scott. But these are honestly amazing machines.
Yeah, you know what? And later, like towards the end of this, I want to give you an update because there's some very recent news about a vehicle that is just – it's going to blow your mind, Ben, what they're talking about with this vehicle. So let's go ahead and start here at the beginning because we've got an article about this, right?
Yes.
Called Could You Commute from New York to Los Angeles in 12 minutes? That's the title of the article, says it all right there. But again, we're talking about not not sonic flight, not supersonic flight, rather.
Right.
We're talking about hypersonic flight.
Yes.
And that reaches into, like you said, science fiction range.
Yes. The Lockheed Martin HTV-2. Mm-hmm. This is an unmanned vehicle built with DARPA's Falcon program. And DARPA, of course, the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, is sort of the mad science wing of our armed forces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you may say mad science, but they've already tested this thing.
Yes,
right?
Twice.
It was a test, and I'm going to mention the one that happened in August because I'm not sure the one prior what happened. Mm-hmm. I know that these things, they were scheduled to actually have a crash landing in the Pacific Ocean. So that
right.
was that was part of the plan, and that's the way it ended. But, Ben, this thing in August of 2011, and now HTV stands for Hypersonic Travel Vehicle.
Yes.
This is unmanned, of course. It achieved 13,000 miles per hour on this test.
Man.
I know, 13,000 miles per hour. And get this, it began to roll. It began to tumble at that speed. And they were somehow able to correct that, which is incredible to me. I don't know how once something like that begins, like this I'll call it a death roll. I don't know how this death roll, and there's no one on board, obviously, but
sure.
I don't know how do you recover from something like that? You're tumbling at like Mach 20 speed. How do you recover from something like that?
There has to be a fairly precise calculation. And it has to happen in an amazingly, in a timely manner.
I mean, I just don't understand how a guidance system can recover from a roll at Mach 20. But again, 13,000 miles per hour, that's just like a bullet in the sky, faster than a bullet, much
mm-hmm.
faster. Now, one thing that began to happen that, you know, during this test, and this is where the concern comes in, because heat builds up at a tremendous rate on something like this, because how do they describe it? You're not really soaring through. The air is not really flowing over you over the vehicle anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You're punching through the air. The air becomes like a wall.
Yeah. It almost seems to be like a fluid. There's an excellent comparison in this article
mm-hmm.
wherein the author says that, a disturbance can only move at a certain speed through any sort of material or any sort of substance.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, air just simply moving through the atmosphere creates enormous friction,
mm-hmm.
Creates enormous amounts of heat.
Now, so much heat and friction that it began to peel away the metal skin that was on this thing, on the HTV-2. So, that was expected. They knew that was going to happen.
Right.
And I think at that point, they lose communication with the thing, and it does ditch itself into the Pacific Ocean just as planned. But, Ben, this is pretty exciting that they're testing vehicles for potential, military use at this point.
Right.
13,000 miles per hour.
Which is amazing. Now, when we say military use, what are we talking about? We are talking about the Prompt Global Strike
mm-hmm.
line of vehicles. And the idea here, the idea that the Pentagon and DARPA were cooking up was basically this question. Can we reach a target anywhere in the world in 60 minutes or less? This is kind of some crazy dominoes rules,
Anywhere in the world in 60 minutes or less. That's
right.
That's absolutely incredible. I mean, think about like fast forms of travel, right? And,
mm-hmm.
people think of like teleportation and things like that. But this is a real way to get something from here to there. I mean, I guess the farthest distance would be the halfway point, right? Exactly halfway around the Earth,
yeah.
right? Because, to come full circle, you just go the other way and it would be much closer, right?
Right, right.
So halfway around the Earth, 60 minutes or less, that's the goal.
Mm-hmm. And we are going to take a look at some of this because, as you said, it did. The vehicle did get skinned alive, not to be too morbid.
Yeah.
It turns out that when we're working with speeds that are this crazy, we have to be very careful about how we position the vehicle, how we build materials to hold it. Because as we said, the strange thing about the August 2011 flight is that they were expecting it to get skinned, right?
Yeah, I got to say something about these materials and the shapes and everything because the shapes have a lot to do with this. And this is interesting because you would think that it would be a real sharp angle shape that you would need for something like this, right?
Right.
Now, the illustration of the vehicle that they show us here, now I can't find any video of this thing crashing into the ocean. I wish I could. That would be so cool to see.
Yeah.
Something 13,000 miles an hour splashing in the ocean. But they mentioned there's a chart here that I found, and it tells you like the Mach speeds and what it's rated at. I guess the ranges of Mach speed. So, you know, supersonic is like, there's a couple of aircraft. There's like the F-104 Starfighter that achieved, it's between 1.2 and 5 and Mach 5, which is really, really fast.
Yeah.
And that's also, that encompasses the Concorde, because I think the Concorde was around 1.2, 1.3, something like that. Then there's hypersonic, which is 5 to 10, Mach 5 to Mach 10. Then there's high hypersonic, which is what we're talking about with these vehicles, really, which is up to Mach 20. So between Mach 10 and Mach 25 is considered high hypersonic. And when you get to that speed, actually the one prior to it, between 5 and 10, Mach 5 and Mach 10, you need to have the skin of the vehicle needs to be cooled.
Mm-hmm.
You got to use nickel titanium skins that are cooled with chemically cooled, so you get to these really advanced designs. But the problem with that is that I think that it also begins to deteriorate the material that the thing is actually
made of because
of the coolant that you have to use. So there's a lot of issues with this. And again, between Mach 10 and Mach 25, which we call high hypersonic. The thermal issues are the main issues that you have to deal with in this thing. So it really, the shapes have to become more of a blunt design, because they can't be these knife-edge angle designs like you have with the fighter jets or any of those things, because the blunt design seems to make I guess the sound waves flow over the I'm going to mess this up, man, because I'm not a scientist, but the sound waves or the heat will flow better around the vehicle, if that's the best way to say it.
And it's so crazy because these things do not look flight-worthy.
No, they don't.
They do not look like flying objects. They look like part of a plane, possibly.
Yeah, but you know what? Think about it this way. Like, think about the capsules, like the Apollo capsules.
Yeah.
Remember how when they re-entered, they had that real rounded shape on the bottom, and they were just kind of – they almost looked like they were just falling, really. I think they pretty much were. They were just falling through the atmosphere. But they were achieving like Mach 25 or above. Mm-hmm. And they had that real rounded shape. And of course, you remember that you could see the flames,
billowing off.
Yeah, it's almost like a stone in a river or something, you know, like the way you would see the water flow around that object. It's similar with, like the heat, and you'd see the fire kind of built up around it that way. Think of the designs that they have to be like that. Now, the problem is, if you're going to have passengers in this thing's got to be able to take off from a runway and land on a runway, right?
Right.
So it's not like a rocket where you can send up a capsule and have stages and let the stages fall off on the way. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of issues with that. But they're working on stuff that will, I guess, get around that issue.
Yeah, it's always so exciting to take a look at the stuff that DARPA is cooking up when it comes to vehicles,
What they show us.
What they show us, yeah. getting close to my other show there. because I don't know, man. You know, I'm so optimistic about this sort of stuff, but I would love to see these as civilian passenger jets. They want to get – what is it? They want to cross the Pacific in 30 minutes?
Something like that, yeah. With a load of passengers on board. Now,
yeah.
Now the thing, you know, with the last test where it's beginning to tumble at Mach 20, that's a little concerning. The other issue, Ben, is that, and this is one of the problems with this, is that the human body just simply can't stand up to something like this right now. And the way we would get there, like let's say that you want to do this type of travel, and a lot of this has to do with getting into the upper atmosphere where there's a lot less air and a lot less air resistance.
Would you say suborbital?
I would say suborbital, yes. carefully say that because it's rough to say. But the problem is the human body can sustain like maybe 1G for a while, and that becomes uncomfortable. Think about like a sports car cornering as hard as it possibly can. That's like 1G. That's really a lot of force on your body, right?
Right.
And we're talking about gravity. So, you know, the 2Gs is like 2 times the force of gravity on your body. So imagine if you're in an aircraft where, you know, for several minutes you're expected to withstand, you know, 3-4 Gs for, you know, 8 or 9 minutes as this thing ramps up to speed. That would be impossible. That's like fighter jet at maximum pull, you know, that type of that type of G. It really would be. And I think a lot of people would end up passing out. You know, it just would not be good. Right now, the idea is that it would be difficult to do something like this because you would have to so gradually creep up to that speed, that Mach 20 speed, or even let's say Mach 10.
Sure.
Just to make it easy. Right?
Yeah, I mean, just to make it survivable.
Yeah, exactly. Survivable at this point. It would be really, really hard and really slow to build up to that speed. The other thing is that, oh, you know what? I'm going to kind of get ahead of myself here if I mention this, but the vehicle that you take off with has to breathe air. When you're in suborbital altitudes, you need a vehicle that really doesn't require air. You need a jet at that point. You need a rocket at that point. Jet, lower altitudes. Rocket at higher altitudes. That's part of one of the main issues with this type of flight right now.
Ken, speaking of suborbital flights, may I give a brief shout out to our buddy Richard Branson?
Of course.
Now, we have off the air sometimes talked about privatization of spaceflight. And this is a fairly exciting thing. Of course, people are often concerned about state space agencies like NASA, most famously, right? And whether or not they're using their funding correctly, whether or not it's a boondoggle or a noble pursuit, and whether or not the future of suborbital or space flight is indeed going to come with from the private side, right?
Sure.
If companies, corporations, private businesses like Virgin Galactic, of course, Richard Branson's brand, are going to pave the way for the future of spaceflight, even possibly before an agency such as NASA. I'm tremendously excited about this. I will probably not be the first person on the plane, but you know, Scott, that this company, Virgin Galactic, is planning to carry civilians to suborbital flight.
Yeah, and I actually believe that they're going to get there. With the amount of money that he throws at this project and the way it seems to be progressing. I mean, I know it's been a while. They've been selling
right.
I mean, Ben, haven't they been selling tickets on this thing since like 2005?
Oh, yeah,
or something
yeah.
That?
Celebrities have been buying them. They're building – they were building a spaceport in New Mexico.
See, people really want this. I think they really want to be able to do this because not only would it be – not just for the cool factor, but also, I mean – my God, how long does it take to fly from New York to Tokyo? I don't have any idea. I should have this in my notes here, but I don't. But it takes a long, long time.
Yeah.
I don't know, 11 hours. Maybe more.
It's got to be more than
more
that.
More than that.
It's got to be
18
more.
Hours. Whatever. It takes a long, long time. Imagine doing that in 90 minutes. Imagine just like getting on the plane, having a little snack, maybe a drink, and you're there.
You couldn't even watch all of Fight Club.
it's incredible. You couldn't even watch an in-flight movie. That's right. I hadn't even thought of that. It's as simple as that. And the idea is that you know you get yourself in a vehicle that is so fast and travels so high that can you know I mean you're not worried about other air traffic at that point. You get up to a certain altitude, and there's much less air resistance. You can travel at any speed you want as long as the vehicle can handle it. And that's the thing. Like we're talking about you know the temperatures. The temperatures are something in the neighborhood of like. You know, 3,500 degrees Fahrenheit, 4,100 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface of this thing. So, I mean, it's really, really critical that they make the vehicle that can withstand this type of thing. And it'll be a whole new concern, you know, with mechanics and you know, regular flight check intervals. I mean, as far as mechanics go on the ground, it's going to be far more intense than current standards, which are really high. So I think there's going to be a lot more specialized, I guess, mechanics that are coming out for stuff like this. Because I mean, you're getting into rocket science.
Yeah, there's going to be an entirely new industry.
There's going to have to be.
And I think that what we're going to see as this technology moves forward is a move toward diversification and specialization, because the HTV-2 is right now. A great idea, a great proof of concept, right? And it's going to be tremendously difficult to have passengers on a vehicle of that magnitude. If we ever take that technology and move it to the civilian, oh, buddy, you thought the Concorde was tough?
Yeah.
This is dangerous.
I've heard that, the SR-71 Blackbird, that was one that's definitely a supersonic jet.
Yeah.
I've heard that when that thing is on the ground, it just leaks like crazy. It leaks all over the place, and people wouldn't expect that. But I don't remember who I heard this from. But they said that the thing leaks every fluid because it's meant to seal up when it gets to the upper altitudes, you know, the heat or the pressure or whatever.
Right.
I'm not sure exactly what plays into it here, but I've heard that on the ground it's not a great vehicle to have parked anywhere because it's going to leave stains everywhere. It's going to be a mess. But everything seals up nice and tight when it should.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different concerns. Now imagine if you had a vehicle that, you know, the skin has to be cooled. So it's got this intricate piping system, and I'm sure it's a very exotic type of fluid and materials that have to be used for this too. Again, mechanics are going to have to be very, very specialized for this type of repair.
And I wish that we were able to get some more information about these vehicles. But here's the thing: as you start digging, you begin to run into classified stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there's a little bit of stuff that, you know, is kind of leaked out here and there.
Yeah, I think that's on purpose, but because, you know, let's keep in mind, again, this is a military innovation at this point. The HTV-2 is a military craft, mm-hmm. and every so often, we've seen this in the modernization of the Chinese military as well. Every so often, there will be a news story that is a finger quote leak,
mm-hmm.
but it's also clearly put out there purposefully to disseminate some information. So I think that the United States wants other countries to know.
Maybe a slight bit of intimidation.
You know what? I think that's fair to say.
Sure, why not?
But also, as a fanboy of real-life spacecraft,
yeah.
which is what these are, I was tremendously sad that I was not able to get more information.
You know what? There are some vehicles out there, though, that you can get information about. In fact, in this article, there's a few mentioned here. This is kind of crazy because, you know, they'll have these press days where, you know, these independent companies that are working on vehicles that can travel at supersonic speeds. They'll have the press, they'll invite the press in and have, you know, a luncheon and mm-hmm. here's our vehicle in the hangar. You can get about 10 feet away from it, but don't touch it, that type of thing.
Yeah, there's like a demo setup of material that you can't touch.
Exactly. So there's a few listed here and some that are kind of, they're hinting at hypersonic speeds
mm-hmm.
That they may or may not be able to do it. But like there's one called, I'm going to say it's called the Zest, Z-E-H-S-T, Zest.
Yeah.
Tickets are something like $8,500 U.S. That's the proposed price. And then we're talking about like something that they're anticipating releasing in 2040. So
mm-hmm.
a long time from now, 2040, 2050, something like that. $8,500 U.S. for a ticket from Tokyo to Paris in about 2.5 hours. Right now, Tokyo to Paris takes about 11 hours. So that gives you an idea of how much time something like this would save. Another one called the Sonic Star,
mm-hmm.
and that can travel at, or they say it can travel at Mach 3.6 at about an altitude of around 60,000 feet. Again, you can go New York to Dubai in 20 minutes, Ben.
Right, 20 minutes.
20 minutes, New York to Dubai. So imagine like you got a lunch meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You could head out in the morning. No problem. Yeah. You've made it.
As you do.
Which is amazing. Yeah. And then there's something called the Lynx, which, what is this? This can cruise around 2,500 miles per hour. The altitude is around 62 miles up, which is really high. But, mm-hmm. man,
which
I mean,
minimizes again the atmospheric difficulties we see. And interesting story about the Lynx. It's a two-seater.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I didn't even read that.
Two-seater aircraft. Yeah,
that's
man.
That's amazing.
So that's kind of the cool one. That's the one you take the date on or you want to impress one of your buddies.
Yeah, yeah. And just to give you an idea, Ben, so we're talking about like, you know, vehicles that are traveling like Mach 3.6 or they're saying that they're going to travel at these speeds, right?
Right.
We do have some current records listed here.
Oh, yes, we do.
So, like the article says, you may wonder how fast we've already gone, right? Manned aircraft, right? So, this is what we're calling the rocket plane, right? Because it's kind of a mix of both, the jet, rocket, the altitudes we're talking about. We've actually had somebody or a vehicle that's traveled at Mach 6.7 That's 4,520 miles per hour, which is incredibly fast. I don't think that I'd want to be around this, but this is a grandchild of Chuck Yeager's X-1 plane, which was the first plane to jet to break the sound barrier. Mm-hmm. And then if you want to go into just strictly airplanes, you know, like the jet-powered airplanes that are air-breathing, we've got someone that has traveled at 2,193 miles per hour. Again, that's the SR-71 Blackbird. So that's the vehicle I was telling you about, the leaky one. But also, that's a different one. There's a MiG jet that has the altitude record at 123,524 feet, which is way, way up there. So, I don't know, a variety of people have traveled different speeds, different altitudes, but nothing like what we're talking about. This is all still kind of twinkle in someone's eye, but but they've tested it, right? It's being tested, and it's on its way. I can guarantee you that it's going to happen. It may happen in 20 years, but it'll happen.
And just so you can baffle your friends at the cocktail party, we wanted to give you some nice facts there. You know, we always like to punch those in. Some of the fastest unpowered flights were the Apollo capsules, which we mentioned before. So that was a 33-mile or 53-kilometer altitude, and the speed, Mach 32.5,
no
on reentry.
Way.
Yeah.
32.5?
And they survived.
Wow.
So that's over 24,000 miles per hour.
Unbelievable.
And, of course, that's unpowered. Clearly, you and I both believe that this technology is worth researching and is continuing. I hope that it does come out. And I'm wondering if this is something that will propagate out, you know, beyond the military to civilians.
Ah, here you go, Ben. I've got some late breaking news, and this is as of late November 2012. As promised, I wanted to tell you about this new engine. Really, it's a British company called Reaction Engines, and you can look this up for yourself. There's press releases. There are, you know, drawings of all this happening. There's some video on site, but they have a program, or maybe an engine, I guess, called Sabre, which stands for Synergistic Air-Breathing Rocket Engine, which is really cool. And I'll tell you how big of a deal this has been. They're actually calling this the biggest breakthrough in propulsion since the jet engine.
Wow.
I know, that's a bold statement, isn't it? But to come out and say this, and this is a respected company.
Right.
Reaction Engines, they are saying this is the biggest breakthrough since the jet engine. So this is a big deal. And amazing thing about this is, now this is where we're talking about, like, getting to the other side of the world in 4 hours, right?
Right.
The thing about this is that it acts at this single engine acts as both a jet and air breathing jet engine. So when that works for the takeoff part and landing part, but it can also work as a fuel burning rocket engine at the same time.
At the same time?
Well, it switches from one mode to the next.
Okay.
So, but it's one unit.
So and when it gets above the altitude for the jet aspect, right?
Correct.
The air reliant, then it just switches to a rocket.
Correct.
Wow.
And then it brings itself back down into the atmosphere and works as a jet engine. Now, this is such a cool thing. And the biggest thing about this anyways, it cools the air. The way that this is really possible is because, again, it comes down to cooling. And they've developed this real system of intricate fine piping that cools the air that flows over the surface all the way down to -150 degrees Celsius in just 1/100th of a second.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
So the cooling is so critical in these things that that's one of the major hurdles in all of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, control and, you know, the shapes of everything, but the heating and the cooling of the vehicle, the skin, the engine, keeping the passengers cool inside or at a reasonable temperature inside, that's a big deal as well. So you can look this up again. It's a British company called Reaction Engines, but that is very recent news in this whole thing.
Okay, Scott, Abe writes in to us to say...
Wait. Abe?
Abe.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that is cool.
I would guess it's short for Abraham.
Yes, I believe it may be.
Okay.
I didn't check the full name, but I think it's in Ezekiel.
Abe, you don't hear a lot of people named Abe.
Yeah, it's a super cool
name. All right, let's move on. I'm sorry.
No, we're off on a good start with Abe. So Abe says, hi, Scott and Ben, longtime listener, huge fan of Car Stuff on How Stuff Works. Thank you. I've been trying to catch up on my listening. I have roughly 93.75 episodes to listen to still, but only roughly. He said, I had to write in since there have been a number of episodes I could relate to or wanted to comment on. I'm listening to them backwards, so the most recent to the oldest. I'll start catching up again. He just heard our Pet Peeves podcast.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And he said, and you guys missed one. It's hard to explain, but I'll take a shot at it. When you're stuck in traffic on a road or avenue and the light ahead of you turns green and you're at the front of the line and you're in the right lane to proceed. Across the intersection, there isn't any space for you to proceed, so naturally you must wait because you don't want to be stuck in the middle of the intersection, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and says, I'm sure the laws are the same for you there. This would be in the Toronto area where he's at.
Okay.
And he says, when the car across the intersection begins to drive forward and you have space to go ahead and someone coming off the cross street, the street perpendicular to yours, wants to make a right into the lane and kind of creeps into it.
Oh, yeah.
He says, so essentially they're taking your spot and you're stuck in the middle of the intersection.
So they're turning right on red in front of you who has the green light and is being considerate. I totally get this.
See, it, he, and Abe said, I hope that translated properly and you can relate, but that, I think, at least is not only a pet peeve, but should be against the law.
Honest, Abe. I understand this completely. I really do. I completely understand that.
And he also just gave us a short list of some cars he owned. So he's owned a 67 Mustang Coupe.
Very nice.
98 Malibu. Mm-hmm. 06 Jetta. Mm-hmm. 2.5 liter. 2010 Hyundai Genesis Coupe.
Oh, excellent.
2013 Hyundai Elantra.
Oh, cool.
So they
Oh, the Genesis Coupe. I'm right with him on that one. That was cool.
Oh, check this out. He says it's probably the best car I've ever owned or driven as far as bang for the buck. I don't think the U.S. got this model until recently.
Yeah.
So, Abe, thank you so much for writing in.
Yeah. And, you know what? Yeah. This makes me think of something.
What's that?
If people could send in a short list of cars that they've owned.
Oh, wouldn't that be cool?
In the beginning, I've kind of got my own that I just keep on my desktop, and I keep adding to it whenever I buy something or sell something.
Mm-hmm.
Not really detailed, just the year and make and model, and that way someday I'll remember this when I'm really old.
Yeah, maybe a little, maybe if you want a little comment about what you did or didn't like.
Yeah, keep it short, but maybe just a short list, like a bullet point list of cars you own, like number one all the way through your current ride.
Yeah, and you can follow up with us on that or tell us what you thought about this episode or some episodes you'd like to hear in the future. Drop us a line at CarStuff on Facebook. Give us a holler on Twitter. Or, if you're feeling old-fashioned, you can always send us an email at
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.